Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This broadcast, conducted by Father Coughlin, is your broadcast. It is supported through the sales of Social Justice Magazine, of which he is editorial counsel, and through the free will offerings which you care to contribute. It is Father Coughlin's objective to support Christianity and Americanism in these days when irreligion and internationalism are creating havoc in our midst. And in turn, your support of him and of social justice enables these programs to continue. His first address today will deal with the subject, Government by Man or Government by Law? His second address, beginning promptly at the half hour, will be entitled, Who Wants War? Please be informed that copies of these addresses are available to all in this audience who will write to Father Coughlin this week. They are yours for the asking. Meanwhile, may I speak a word of encouragement to the distributors of Social Justice. Ladies and gentlemen, in the name of Social Justice Publishing Corporation, we extend to you our thanks for your valiant support. Please maintain the high standard of Christianity and Americanism which has characterized your endeavors. Be not perturbed by the disturbers whose objective it is to make you the target of criticism. You are the ladies and gentlemen who have made possible the daily broadcast, Monday through Friday, over WHIP, the Chicago outlet at Hammond, Indiana, and over CKLW of Windsor, Ontario, the Detroit outlet. This latter broadcast will begin Wednesday. Other cities will enjoy these daily comments on the news as soon as circulation warrants. And now for Father Coughlin's first address.
Ladies and gentlemen and friends, all about us a deteriorating change is evident in the political world. The rule of man is superseding the rule of law. And oftentimes those who are responsible for it are unmindful that it is synonymous with decay. Intelligent persons do not desire to sustain the irregularities and immoralities which in part characterize the last 30 or 40 years of our lives. No intelligent person desires to sustain the well-known causes which produced the concentration of wealth in the hands of a few and the multiplication of poverty on the backs of the many. No one desires to sustain the moral and social irregularities responsible for the World War, for the savage Treaty of Versailles, for the existence of unbearable taxation, and for the many other iniquities which weigh so heavily upon us. A change from these things is imperative. To abandon these irregularities, everyone admits, is of vital importance. But to abandon them at the cost of destroying the divine and natural laws, including the commandments of God, the doctrines of Christ, and the constitution of our nation, that will lead us from the present depths of our misery to a lower degradation. A rule of sound law is necessary, and any tendency which aims at substituting the rule of man for the rule of law must be halted. Probably you have observed that recently there has been adopted a policy of procuring this rule of man under the guise of good, on the principle that a successful wolf always wears sheep's clothing. Beginning with the Peace Treaty of Versailles, this policy became very noticeable. When Clemenceau signed that document, so the story goes, he threw down his pen and said, "There, that paper will be good for 14 wars within the next dozen years." Later on, we Americans succumbed to this same hypocrisy of wolfism. As an instance, I cite the Gold Nationalization Bill, which, when put into operation, turned out to be the Gold Confiscation Bill. It was just one of many pieces of legislation which bore a deceptive name. So it is with the neutrality proposals which are presented to us this week for our acceptance or our rejection. Upon analysis, these neutrality bills are nothing more than unneutrality bills. Bills which, if passed with all the provisions set down by Saul Bloom of the House of Representatives, or with the provisions demanded by Keith Pittman in the United States Senate, most certainly will force the United States and its citizens to commit themselves to a policy of war, of dictatorship, and of final and complete government by man and not by law. Following last Sunday's broadcast, we read on Monday morning that President Roosevelt classified the proposed neutrality bills as must legislation. He practically said that Congress must retain and remain in session until either the Bloom Bill or the Pittman Bill would be passed or rejected. Do you remember how some years ago the House of Deputies in Italy voted themselves out of existence? Do you recall how the Third German Reich voted into power an absolute dictator? Do you recollect what happened in 1917 in Soviet Russia? How Leninism was born? How a small political party, composed of not more than 1/100th of the population of Russia, came to power? In each instance, their objectives were achieved through sheep's clothing legislation under which the wolf of tyranny and one-man rule rose to power. In each instance, the masses of the people were deceived with labels. In each instance, the citizens of these various countries were not given an opportunity to analyze and inspect the contents of the legislation, which eventually reduced them to the order of state slaves. And in each instance, the rule of man superseded the rule of law. I ask you, shall the American people be deceived by a similar maneuver? That is the vital question which should occupy our minds during these inactive midsummer weeks. Taking advantage of this apathetic season when men's minds are occupied with recreation, the proponents of the so-called neutrality bills, either knowingly or unknowingly, are endeavoring to institute a coup d'etat which, if successful, will leave America with its flag, its liberties, its republican form of government, its House of Representatives, its Senate, and its Constitution as so many labels to indicate what once was and what now is not. I recognize that this is a strong statement. I recognize that millions in this audience probably will not be impressed with such words because they cling to the fallacy of it can't happen here-ism. The same fallacy which lulled to sleep the peoples of Italy, Germany, and Russia in our own lifetime. Despite this unfortunate attitude, I dare offer to you an opportunity to strip the label from the bottle of this new concoction, called the Neutrality Bill, and subject its contents to actual scrutiny before you swallow it, and with it, swallow the rule of man and not the rule of law. Last Sunday, I read for you an editorial from the Intelligencer of Wheeling, West Virginia, which clearly pointed out that if such legislation as this Neutrality Bill should pass, the president of our country, whoever he may be, would be empowered to name the unjust aggressor in any war happening anywhere in all the wide world, and that this president would be empowered by virtue of the neutrality bill to aid with arms, munitions, and credit any nation in all the world suffering from any aggressor whom he judged to be an aggressor. This means that instead of being neutral, we Americans would take sides. Instead of being peaceful, we Americans would participate in war. Instead of upholding the spirit of the Monroe Doctrine, which confines our activities to the Americas, we Americans would spread ourselves over the entire world? And instead of revering George Washington's policy of no foreign entanglements, we Americans would adopt Lenin's policy of world revolution or Britain's policy of world empire. In metaphorical language, my friends, the benign Uncle Sam would doff his familiar attire to wear an international policeman's uniform, the same dear old gentleman who has been so unsuccessful lately in policing the beat infested by rapacious aggressors here in America. Of course, every informed American knows that this is totally un-American. According to our Constitution, it is the business of Congress to make foreign policy and to declare war and to name unjust aggressors if and when necessary. That's the Constitution of the United States. What would happen, therefore, to this power now vested in Congress should either the Bloom Bill or the Pittman Neutrality Bill be passed? Congressmen who will vote for this bill will vote away their constitutional rights, and in doing so, they will vote away the rights of we the people, because after all, congressmen are only the representatives of the people. Moreover, according to our Constitution, and this is according to sound Americanism, the president whom we only indirectly elect to office is nothing more than the chief executive, his business it is to execute the laws passed by Congress and in accordance with the Constitution of our country. By virtue of either the neutrality bills, he will become more than an executive. In fact, he will become a judge. In fact, he will become a judge not only of the internal affairs respecting the United States, but of all international activities. And in fact, he will become the Lord of the world. Do not cast this assertion aside so lightly. Do you not recognize that the United States is the most powerful nation in the world today? That despite the widespread poverty among the masses, we constitute the wealthiest nation in the world, indeed in the world's history? In our possession is almost three-quarters of all the commercial gold in the world. Through our factories, we control almost one-half the industry of the world, including its armament. On whatsoever side, therefore, we throw our power, our force, our prestige, and our wealth, that is the side where, in all probability, victory will reside, a victory decided by might and not by right. I ask you, without any disrespect to Mr. Roosevelt or to any other future president, is this democracy? Is there any one man living today who is intelligent enough to judge the rightfulness or wrongfulness of international events which occur in mid-Europe or mid-Asia or mid-South Africa? If after 6 years or more of endeavoring to judge what is wrong with the United States of America's internal affairs, how could Mr. Roosevelt or any other president claim the ability to judge what is wrong with foreign affairs? Possibly there are some in this audience who entertain the opinion that I am far-fetched in my fears. But they have not read the Saul Bloom Neutrality Bill, nor the Keene Pittman Neutrality Bill. They have contented themselves with reading headlines. Therefore, permit me at this juncture to reproduce a portion of an article from the Christian Science Monitor, dated June 5th, which partially analyzes these neutrality bills, bills which, unfortunately, at the moment, enjoy the support of the New Deal political party, as did the bills which transformed Italy, Germany, and Russia into dictatorships. enjoy the support of the fascist, the Nazi, and the Bolshevik Party. The Christian Science Monitor says in part, quotations, virtually every provision of the proposed neutrality bills contains a clause which would enable the president to nullify or greatly to vary its application. The chief provisions and qualifications which come into effect after the president finds a war to exist and names the parties are these. 1. American ships and citizens are banned from areas of combat operation. But the president may define the combat areas as he chooses. And moreover, the ban is made to apply as the president shall prescribe. There's the rule of man. 2. American citizens may not travel on ships flying any belligerent flag, says the neutrality bill. But this travel is forbidden except in accordance with rules and conditions as the president shall prescribe. Again, the rule of man. 3. No loans to the belligerent shall be floated in the United States. But the president may exempt ordinary commercial credits and short-term obligations of a peacetime commercial type. Again, the rule of man. 4. The title must be transferred to the foreign purchaser of any exported article before they may leave this country. But this ban operates except in accordance with such rules and regulations as laid down by the president. Again, the rule of man. And so forth through all these various provisions of the two neutrality bills. Laws are seemingly cited in the bill itself. But at the end of each qualification, there appears, Mr. Roosevelt may decide when, if, where, and what. In a word, the bill, again quoting the Christian Science Monitor, approaches fairly close to saying, in times of foreign war, the president shall conduct American foreign policy for the most part as he sees fit. My friends, I believe that the excerpt with my annotations from the Christian Science Monitor is a fair analysis of the neutrality bills now engaging the attention of Congress this week. My chief opposition to the bills is vested in the fact that they partially destroy the Constitution of the United States. Insofar as Congress will surrender one of its most important rights to the president, and insofar as this bill practically makes the president of the United States the lord of the world, it is democracy in reverse. It is un-Americanism in the saddle. It is dictatorship in the bud. And above all, it is a definite departure from rule by law and a definite approach to rule by man. In these days when we are searching about for security, are we not convinced that there can be no security unless it is founded upon law, which is in harmony with the immutable laws of God? No man is above law. But if this tendency persists in setting up dictators and lords of the world whose decisions are established not upon constitutional laws in harmony with God, but upon their own personal judgment independent of congressmen, courts, and even the commandments of God, there is no limitation of the excesses into which such a barbaric principle may lead us, even though it be clothed with the name of democracy and progress. Last Sunday I indicated that in this present instance, Mr. Roosevelt is not well qualified to be an impartial judge upon the subject of unjust aggression. His well-advertised affinity for imperialistic France and Britain, that's notorious. The same Great Britain who has been lending hundreds of millions of dollars recently to foreign nations and always finding an excuse to refrain from paying even the interest on the debt she owes us. The same Great Britain whom our Gold Purchase Act benefited by almost $2 billion. And moreover, as I observed last Sunday, Mr. Roosevelt is likewise notorious for his unbounded friendship for the Bolsheviks of Soviet Russia and elsewhere. Oh, to sustain that observation, I quoted two official documents from our State Department issued on June 6th of this year. On that day, it so happened that the Spanish ambassador, Senor Don Juan Francisco de Cardenas, and the Russian ambassador, Konstantin Umansky, both presented their letters of credence from their governments to Mr. Roosevelt. In reply to the Spanish ambassador, Mr. Roosevelt said that the American government will be ever ready to cooperate with the Spanish government for progressive understanding and peace. But in reply to the representative from the Soviet Republics of Russia, Mr. Roosevelt is recorded perpetually in history as having said the following: "It has given me deep satisfaction to hear from you of the feeling of genuine friendship which the peoples of the Soviet Union have for the American people, a feeling you are assured is fully reciprocated. I have noted," continues the president, "your statement that the purpose of your mission is to strengthen and develop friendship and friendly cooperation between our two countries. You may be sure," concludes Mr. Roosevelt, "that you will enjoy my full support as well as every assistance of the government of the United States in your efforts to achieve this purpose," unquote. No deep friendship for the Spaniards who fought and bled for the cause of freedom and religion against the Rosenbergs, the Del Veos, the Negrins, and the Passionarias, who boasted of their participation in the slaughter of Christians and the destruction of Christianity. Oh, but for Mr. Rumansky, representing a government that despoiled churches, desecrated crucifixes, and waded literally to power through the blood of millions of God-fearing citizens because they were God-fearing, Mr. Roosevelt said that the American people entertain a feeling of genuine friendship for the Bolsheviks and that the American people will enjoy his full support as well as every assistance of the government of the United States for the Bolsheviks. This statement, my friends, is conclusive of the contention I made. And that statement discloses to all posterity where Mr. Roosevelt's affections lie. Oh, yes. In times previous, our people and our congressmen fought vigorously against our participation in the League of Nations. In other days, we rose up valiantly to oppose our entrance into the World Court. And now, through the subterfuge of the Neutrality Bill, which, if passed, will accomplish everything which both the League and the World Court proponents had hoped to accomplish, and in a more direct manner, now I appeal to you to bestir yourselves in order to preserve our policies of no foreign entanglements and in order to support the principle of rule by law, not rule by man. Last Sunday, I invited you to write to your United States Senator pleading with him and petitioning him to support only that kind of neutrality which supports no foreign entanglements and which does not propose to make of any one man the lord of this world. This week, my friends, let it be your concern to multiply your letters to your United States Senator. And if you have time and opportunity,
I ask you to write a second letter. A second letter to your United States representative containing the same petition. Also, the representatives from the following states are at this moment of chief concern to us. Namely, Illinois. Mark these down, please. Illinois, Michigan, Indiana, Ohio, Massachusetts, New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania. The representatives from these states this week must be contacted in order to keep America for the Americans and free from foreign entanglements. I recognize that the world is fraught with the spirit of war. No one can foretell what is about to happen in Europe. No one in America is fully advised as to what will take place in Asia. But this we do know, that European nations are arming themselves to the teeth, that international capitalism is represented by Great Britain and France and Soviet Russia. Yes, Soviet Russia, the latter in an undercover manner, is gambling for the support of the United States of America, and that Nazism, which denies liberty of conscience to its citizens, is pursuing its destructive policy in opposition to the former. With none of these heresies may we Americans participate in military affairs. Call our policy, if you will, that of isolationism, and name the other policy that of internationalism. But nevertheless, our concern, despite the battle of labels and fictitious names in which we find ourselves engaged, must be the policy of America for Americans, founded upon the Christian principles of peace and justice. And when peace and justice, peace amongst the classes and justice for all, when these will have been fulfilled, then and not until then will it be time for us to contemplate an excursion to foreign shores. But we will permit no one to name as an unjust aggressor either of these Nazis, or Bolsheviks, or imperialists, in order to place us upon the side of any of them against Americanism. Therefore, this week I plead with you to write your congressman in the House of Representatives from the states which I indicated, and to write your United States senator to remember the traditions of Washington, to remember the policy of no foreign entanglements, and to remember the Constitution which places law above man.
The address to which you have just listened is available in pamphlet form. Simply write a letter to Father Coughlin this week, and your copy will be mailed to you promptly.
Coughlin's address is coming to you as a presentation on your dial at 1250 kilocycles. WHBI Hoyt Brothers Incorporated, Newark, New Jersey.
Ladies and gentlemen, once again it is my privilege to present to you Father Coughlin in his second address entitled, Who Wants War? Father Coughlin.
My friends, according to the neutrality bills, which are engaging the attention of congressmen this week, we are about to venture upon a policy of naming foreign aggressors. If we must venture upon such a policy, let us begin at home and name domestic aggressors. For we are not little children to be practiced upon by a psychiatrist whose objective is to disengage us from the burning question which occupies our domestic mind by dangling before our eyes the glitter of foreign distraction. With this thought in mind, may I ask your indulgence while I address my remarks to a Pittsburgh gentleman who wrote to me in response to a previous Sunday's discourse. I shall read his letter for you and publicly answer the writer who is representative of a class. The letter reads as follows. Sir, you are certainly opposed to the passing of a neutrality bill which might get us into war. I remember last year a friend of mine in Pittsburgh wrote you a letter when you were campaigning for a policy of peace, with its poverty and strikes and unemployment and low wages. The only time we working men ever had prosperity was when we had war. In our labor unions, we are agitating to stir the folks up against Germany and Japan. We can clean these nations out, and while doing a little good for the world, we can do a lot of good for ourselves. As long as the Spanish Civil War lasted, we had a little prosperity in this steel town. But now we are broke. Why not line up with England and France and Russia? They will ensure our prosperity. And that's the letter. This letter, unquestionably, is the result of the propaganda being spread amongst the laboring class, and spread, alas, too often by those who are supposed to be the leaders of the laboring class. My Pittsburgh friend, have you and I reached the decadent state of civilization when the only hope for bread and butter lies in the direction of war? Are you blind to the wealth of America, its far-flung fields, its majestic forests, its rich mines, its magnificent network of transportation, and its teeming cities, teeming with scientists, executives, and skilled workmen? Look around you. There are millions of men circumstanced as you are, men in whose hearts there is the same burning desire to enjoy in peace and security the good things that God has given to us to use. It is not God who withholds them from us. Oh, but the obstruction which keeps bread from your family and clothing from your children, and doctor's care from your wife, need I suggest to you who are responsible for it? Yes, you have no money to buy them. The nation has no money to buy them. Oh, a purposeful policy to keep the poor, poor. Thus you are of the opinion that we must have war to create prosperity. Is your memory so dull that you are so forgetful of the sufferings and sacrifices which are the lasting result of every war? Roll back the curtain of time, sir. Review the frightful days of 1914 and 18. Who, I ask you, lived in the filthy trenches, underfed and underpaid? Your brother laborers. Whose bodies languished in hospital and whose feet walked the highway to death? 37.5 million of your fellow laborers. Who marched in the bread lines and tramped the pavements of your Pittsburgh and my Detroit, of Berlin, London, Rome, and Moscow and Paris following the armistice? 75 million of your fellow working men. Your fellow working men who joined the great union of destruction. They were men just like you who believed spellbinding labor leaders and spellbinding politicians. Poor laboring men who accepted without analysis the purple words of so-called patriots. Words that scattered bullets for death. Words that dug shell holes for graves, and words that built soup kitchens on every highway of America. Words that created want in the midst of plenty. Words that have strangled you and your kind on the scaffold of poverty. Are you forgetful of those things? Of old, the prophet Isaiah chastened his wayward people for their attitude they had taken similar to yours. You have said, thundered he, you have said we have entered into a league with death and we've made a covenant with hell. For the mess of pottage which this year and next year that you and your fellow workers may gain by manufacturing shells and shrapnel and cannons and howitzers, are you, Mr. Pittsburgher, willing to sign the covenant with death? Are you prepared to agitate your fellow working men to make an agreement with hell? Mr. Steelwalker, I sympathize with you because you were denied an opportunity to learn the truthful story of war. No one explained to you that the world war with its horrors, suffering, and essential bestiality was a planned conflict between the laboring men of America, England, Canada, Germany, and every nation. Planned by the exploiters of the poor so that they would destroy each other in the ideals of brotherhood and keep upon their dripping thrones the invisible lords of oppression. Laboring men of America and of the world, why must you like wolves tear at each other's throats? Wolves train for the slaughter with the food and the shelter and the few rags which are flung to you as bait. To keep the merchandisers of murder and their plunder safe and secure. Have you not learned from the bitter experience of yesterday? Or despite that horrible lesson, will you permit yourselves to be victimized again when the bugle summons you and your grown-up sons to enroll once more in a league with death and sign a covenant with hell? As for our lining up with England, Mr. Steelwalker, let me tell you what England thinks of our having lined up with her during 1914 and 18. In the Congressional Record of June 19, 1939, page 10453, the following exposition is printed. Quotation. During a recent trip to Europe, Mr. Winston Churchill, First Lord of the Admiralty, in the British Cabinet during the World War, invited Mr. Griffin to call on him at his home in London. During the course of a long visit, Mr. Churchill asked what were some of the questions uppermost in the minds of the American people regarding Anglo-American relations. And Mr. Churchill said to Mr. Griffin, quote, I think that England should pay every single dollar she has borrowed from your country. But before paying in full, she should be allowed to deduct half the cost of all the shot and shell she fired at the Germans from the time America declared war until she put soldiers in the front line trenches over a year later. Asked if we allowed England to make the deduction in question, how much it would amount to, Mr. Churchill answered, I was in a position to know just how much it cost England to carry on the war, and according to my figures, England should be allowed to deduct $4,900,000,000 from the debt America claims England owes her before a final settlement is made. When you declared war, you became partners in war. And therefore your country should be willing to bear its just cost of carrying on the war. And Mr. Churchill said, England would have not lost the war had America remained at home. Because, said he, quoting Mr. Churchill, we would have made peace with Germany in the spring of 1917. And by so doing, would have saved over 1 million British and French lives. America's entrance into the war was disastrous, not only for your country, Mr. Griffin, but for the Allies as well. Because had you stayed at home and minded your own business, we Englishmen would have made peace with the Central Powers in the spring of 1917, and then there would have been no collapse in Russia, followed by communism, no breakdown in Italy, followed by fascism, and Nazism would not at present be enthroned in Germany. If America had stayed out of the war and minded her own business, none of these isms would today be sweeping the continent of Europe and breaking down parliamentary government. That, my friends, and particularly you, Mr. Steelwalker from Pittsburgh, is what England thinks of our having gone into the last World War as her ally. My friends, when will you recognize the consequences of war and of foreign entanglement? Disregarding the toll which it has taken abroad upon your fellow laborers in Europe and Asia, Mr. Working Man, what benefits did you gain at home as a result of it? Need I point to the idle steel mills in Pittsburgh, the idle motor factories in Detroit, and the idle textile mills in New England? Need I remind you of the high cost of living, or tell you why it is high? It is not high because your brother farmer has been paid too much for his wheat and corn, his butter and eggs and his pork. It is not high because your butcher or your baker or your grocer is exacting too much profit from you and your fellow laborer. The cost of living is high because the kept politicians in America are dipping into your weekly pay envelope, taking one out of every $3 you earn to pay their masters, the war profiteers, and you want more of it. While on this subject, I will tell you something which you will not believe, probably, but which nevertheless is the truth. As far back as 1927, 28, and 29, you and your fellow working men and the farmers were purchasing on credit homes and motor cars and refrigerators. Suddenly the depression came upon you. And what happened? Because you could not keep up your payments, your home, your farm, your motor car was confiscated. Well, that you know. Oh, there was no moratorium on debts for the idle laborer or the downtrodden farmer. There is none today. But you do not know. You do not know that there has been a constant moratorium on debts for all the executives employed in all the banks affiliated with the Federal Reserve System. Why on June the 16th, 1933, a moratorium was declared by this New Deal administration on the bankers' debt, on the money they borrowed from banks with which to speculate, to buy homes, to purchase bank stock. And every year since 1933, that moratorium has been extended for their benefit. Did you get a moratorium? Are you excused for paying your rent, paying off your home and your car? Oh, no, Mr. Pittsburgher. But these other men are. Their holdings are not confiscated. The controller of the currency spoke in favor of that debt extension or moratorium for bankers, thereby voicing the official benedictions of the New Deal government that has been so kind to you. Oh, yes, there's class legislation for you. And if you're anxious to oppose any unjust aggressor, therefore, let your opposition be aimed at the unjust aggressors engaged in confiscating homes, property, and farms. At the unjust aggressors whose policies create scarcity, unemployment, class hatred, and class favoritism. At the unjust aggressors of ignorance, misinformation, and propaganda. That the unjust aggressors who in this land of plenty are responsible for your needless want. And you want war. My friends, picture Christ weeping over the Jerusalem of old that rejected him. Weeping over the laborers, the slaves, the Greeks, the Jews, the Romans, and the cosmopolitan populace of that capital, because refusing to disentangle themselves from the devouring insanity of a pagan imperialism, they turned their backs on him and chose to follow the immoralities of the Caesars. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them that are sent to thee, how often would I have gathered thy children as the bird doth her brood under her wings, and thou wouldst not, cried the disappointed Christ. My fellow citizens, when men are busy protecting the gospel of slavery, the gospel that brought Rome to the pinnacle of greatness, only to hurl her into the black gorge of destruction, picture this same Christ seated upon some peak of the Rockies or the Appalachians, scanning the fields and the cities of our nation, scanning Pittsburgh with its steel mills, New England with its textile factories, Detroit with its motor industry. I wonder if he is shedding tears for the desolation and havoc which has risen roughshod over the plains of the Middle West. I wonder if his heart is sad as he beholds the millions resident in our great city. Millions whom he has fed and clothed through the miracles of inventions. Millions who, having turned their backs upon him, have walked with him no more. But like sheep are being led to slaughter by the Judas goats of high finance and of high politics, solicitous only for their 30 pieces of silver, which they will obtain by selling you, Christ's brothers, for carnage and crucifixion on some foreign battlefield, with which they hope to have you enter through the back door of a neutrality bill. Oh, America, America, how often would I have gathered thy children as the bird doth her brood under her wing, and thou wouldst not. Mr. Pittsburgher, the ancient Jewish prophet's words perchance are still upon his lips as he peers over the parapets of heaven. Shall he speak them to you? Shall he chide us for having made a league with death and a covenant with hell? Oh, cannot you see that the contest between peace and war, between law and chaos, is a contest between Christ and Antichrist? Believe me, Mr. Laboring Man, your kind has always been the victim from the beginning of time for having rejected Christ, for not having heeded his doctrines. Your kind, lured on by some fantastic cry of patriotism and emotionalized by some barbaric sound of bugle and drum, your kind shall be the victim again. Again. If Congress succeeds in passing the so-called Neutrality Act, which conceals under its euphonious name the sordid sores of internationalism and the devouring worms of war. Mr. Walking Man, do you know, as Handsome Baldwin informs us, that copies of the German Heinkel plane, an airplane, are still in use in the Russian Air Force? Those flying squadrons which, according to Hitler, now cast the shadows of their fearsome wings above the Germans? What a joke upon you, laboring men. And do you know, Mr. Laboring Man, that British Rolls-Royce engines power some German planes, while Downing Street and Horbelicia profess to regard the German air fleet as a threat over London? What a joke upon the laboring men of the world. Yes, you write to me advocating that I silence my voice against war because it will interfere with your prosperity. You're ignorant of the fact that your own America has manufactured munitions and exported tons of armament and raw material to the Japan, who at this moment would have us fight them. Munitions and armaments and raw material to be used in slaughtering your neighbor's son. When will you laboring men achieve intelligence and to recognize that you are the pawns of the international warmongers? The merchandiser of murders, he's busy planning propaganda to excite such persons as you and promising prosperity to lure your sons and all sons to keep their covenant with death. Were you schooled in the book of experience? You, Mr. Pittsburgher, and all laboring men and all Americans were organized to drive once and for all from the shores of America, of Europe and Asia, those profiteering Iscariots who are responsible for purposeful depressions and purposeful wars. Yes. Defend your country unto death. When will you have courage to demand that not one American boy shall proceed beyond the 10-mile limit of our shores to fight the battles of the Prince of Darkness? When will you laboring men stand together in all the continents and all the countries to demand that no American man shall manufacture munitions to kill Englishmen or Frenchmen or Germans or Russians or Spaniards or anyone else? Must you make your livelihood by becoming a slave of the merchandiser of murder? My friend, yes, every person in this audience, the Prince of Peace who became the Man of Sorrows, is saddened by the thoughts and actions of those who would cast America into the cauldron of war. It is your duty and mine to dry his eyes as he weeps over this new Jerusalem, by resolving to become apostles of brotherly love. Once more, in view of the pressing urgency which the two proposed neutrality bills has created, I plead with each person in this audience to write two letters this week. One to his United States representative resident in Washington, the other to his United States Senator. Plead with them for America. and for the American working men, who are always the target of the shrapnel, who are always the corpses in the grave. Oh, plead with your congressman and with your senator to keep us clear from all foreign entanglements, to refrain from granting congressional powers to the president to name an unjust aggressor in Europe or Asia or elsewhere. In either the Sol Bloom neutrality bill or the Key Pittman neutrality bill, if either one of them is passed, America will become the policeman of the world. Internationalism will be substituted for our own nationalism. The rule of man will supersede the rule of law. And you, Mr. Working Man, you, as were the working men in 1916, you'll learn how to stop the machine gun barrage and the shrapnel. You'd better learn how to die and say goodbye to those who you love. My friends, on previous occasions, you did succeed in stemming the activities of those who would have forced us into the membership of the League of Nations and the World Court. These neutrality bills, I warn you, are nothing more than the revived doctrines of the League of Nations and the World Court, with our president the supreme judge, the supreme lord of the world. Keep America for the Americans. And if we must name unjust aggressors, name those men in our midst who are purposefully starving you, purposefully confiscating your homes, and purposefully spreading the gospel that prosperity is founded only in the victims of their war. God bless you. Every one of them. God keep you.
Ladies and gentlemen, today Father Coughlin has appealed to you to participate in keeping America for Americans. He asks you to write two letters, one to your United States representative, the representative from your congressional district, the second to your United States senator, both of them resident at Washington. May I add that you invite not one, but several friends to do likewise. Your apathy or carelessness will cost you your liberties. Your interest in this matter will preserve these same liberties. These broadcasts have been paid for by Social Justice Publishing Corporation and will continue only so long as subscribers to Social Justice Magazine will render them possible, or so long as individuals in this audience care to contribute towards this broadcast. Until next Sunday afternoon, this is your announcer, Franklin Mitchell, bidding you good afternoon.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've presented the regular Sunday afternoon address of Father Charles E. Coughlin from Royal Oak, Michigan. Statements made and views expressed on this program are made on the sole responsibility of the sponsor and do not reflect the views of this station, its management, or personnel. Father Coughlin's address came to you as a presentation on your dial at 1250 kilocycles.